Thanks for listening to the Suzy Larson Life podcast, available thanks to support from listeners like you. It's on, just a matter of... You're listening to an encore presentation of Suzy Larson Life. Welcome to Suzy Larson Live. Always so honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. What's the most common song you hear played at funerals? You know what it is? It's Amazing Grace. But do you know the story behind the song? That its writer was once a greedy slave trader, and he was a ship's captain who would retreat to his cabin to study his Bible, to write love letters to his wife, while hundreds of slaves were shackled in chains down below. How did God awaken John Newton's heart to the point of brokenness, sorrow, repentance, amazing grace? What was his mindset when he wrote that famous classic song, Amazing Grace? Well, Bruce Hindmarsh and Craig Borlase join me today to talk about their new, really beautiful book, Amazing Grace, The Life of John Newton and the Surprising Story Behind the Song. And I'll just tell you, this book reads like a novel. It's just beautiful, lyrical writing. It takes you right into the story. I mean, you can almost hear the waves crashing as you're reading along. We've got a few copies to give away today. Again, the title is Amazing Grace, The Life of John Newton and the Surprising Story Behind the Song. You can text the word book to get in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. Got a quick announcement before we hear from these guys, and that's just this. If you've not downloaded our free Faith Radio app, I want you to do it today. It's free, and it allows you to go anywhere, travel around the world, and live stream our shows and never miss another show. You can also catch the podcast from there and even read our blog post articles, all from the Faith Radio app. So just go to the App Store, search Faith Radio Network, and you'll find it. All right, let me tell you about my guests. We'll get them on the show. Bruce Hindmarsh is the James M. Houston Professor of Spiritual Theology and Professor of History of Christianity at Regent College in Vancouver. He wrote his doctoral thesis at Oxford on John Newton. Bruce speaks and writes regularly for academic and general audiences around the world on history, theology, and the spiritual life. He is a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and a past president of the American Society of Church History. Wow. He's going to be interesting to talk to. Craig Borlase is a New York Times, Sunday Times, and international best-selling ghostwriter of dramatic, engaging memoirs. Over the last two decades, he's written more than 55 books, working with a diverse range of authors for a global audience. Previous work has taken him to Iraq, Jordan, China, Haiti, India, Sweden, Cuba, Uganda, Australia, and all over the U.S. Wow. This is the one time I'll have you guys talk at the same time. Bruce and Craig, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susie. It's lovely to be with you.
Lovely to be with you. Looking forward to the conversation. Well, we start every day just making it personal, talking about what God's teaching us. So, Craig, I'll start with you. What has God been impressing upon your heart these days?
Susie, you know, I was going to say something. Had it all planned. And now I'm thinking I'm going to tell something different. So I was in a Quaker meeting a couple of years ago, and I was sitting next to a guy who was blind. And he started talking. He said, when my Marie, and everybody, I guess, knew that Marie was his wife. When my Marie died, he said, I was really upset with God. I kept on asking God to talk to me, but I didn't hear anything. And he went on, he paused a little bit. Then he went on and said, so my name for God now is the Silent Silence. I remember sitting next to this guy and thinking, oh my word, you can't say that about God. You can't say God's silent. I've been brought up evangelical. God's talking all the time. And then over the years, these last couple of years, it was COVID and various other things. I must admit, my opinion has changed a little bit. I don't know whether that's how I feel about the silence particularly, but I do know that there's an awful lot to be gained in terms of spiritual depth and understanding in me shutting up and just pausing and waiting and waiting and waiting. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've got for you, Susie.
It's beautiful. That's wonderful. Thank you for that so much. I think sometimes we see prayer as kind of a one-way dialogue, but the idea of us being the silent ones, there is a verse in Scripture that talks about that, not to be so quick to speak in the presence of God. And wow, that's beautiful. Well, Bruce, what about you?
Well, thank you, Susie. It's One of the things I've been thinking about, I've had impressed on my mind, it's in my church, we say the Apostles' Creed every Sunday, and it has a line, I believe in the forgiveness of sins. I believe in the forgiveness of sins. And it's something that becomes almost commonplace sort of growing up in the church. But it has been more impressed on me. And this sort of maybe segues a little into our conversation about the book. But I turned 60 last year. And, it's impossible to grow older without having regrets. If you don't have regrets, you're not paying attention. And just to realize that we need the mercy, the forgiveness of God all the way to the end. And the older we get, the more we need this. The closer you get to the light, the more impurities are showing up. And so I've just the verse that I've been thinking about a lot is Hebrews 12, 24. The sprinkled blood speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. What will ever, Abel murdered, nothing will bring him back. Where do we turn? Where did we turn when the world just is not as it should be? But that the sprinkled blood speaks a deeper word, It's like in Narnia, the deeper magic from the dawn of time. We need to go deeper. And so I've been thinking about that and been grateful in a renewed way that God's forgiveness reaches just so deep.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. Well, Bruce, I'm going to start with you on this one. Talk about how this book was born in your hearts.
Well, I think as you mentioned in your intro, I did my doctoral work on John Newton at Oxford, and I'd sort of knew a bit about his story, and I'd read various, inspirational biographies that have been written over the years. But I didn't realize until I started to dig a bit that there's a massive archive. There's all these letters and all these manuscripts and so on. And so I sort of got to know John Newton and admired him as a pastor and his role in the evangelical awakening between, let's say, between the conversions of John Wesley and the work of William Wilberforce. And so I thought long and hard about his life and his ministry. I admired the way he became a gentle and a wise pastoral counselor and a powerful preacher, and especially a spiritual director. He wrote letters, thousands of letters, and I've read a lot of them. My kids used to say that their dad, for a living, read dead people's mail. And but then I sort of, having done John Newton, I sort of put that aside and did other things. But it's the 250-year anniversary of the writing and the singing of Amazing Grace, and so it's been a chance to revisit this. And so I think that was the occasion. But I think what put it on our hearts is our friend Charles Morris kind of got us together, and he had this sense that this should happen. And he had the sense that the two of us should do it. So Craig flew over from England, came to our house, and I think we both kind of wondered, who is this person and can I work with this person? I think we even had a Zoom call before that. But I can tell you honestly, Susie, that one of the most precious things that's come out of this experience with, for me has been a friendship with Craig, and working together has just meant the world to me. And as a side benefit, we got to, I think, produce what I hope is a beautiful book.
And first of all, love Charles Morris. I've served with him on a media panel before, and what a gentle, wonderful man. So that's beautiful. But wow, what a great, great story. You talked about his spiritual direction and his pastorship. Craig, say a word though about his younger years because that he really was, talk about transformation. I mean, he had a rough past as a child and then even as a young adult. So say a bit about that.
Yeah, Susie, for me, this was the way in. Just to backtrack a little bit. So even before that Zoom call, which Bruce mentioned that we had with Charles when he introduced us, Charles had asked me twice before to consider the book. And my first reaction was like, well, it's going to be a little dull. I don't really want to do it. Like a book about a song. I mean, that's going to be awkward. Even but I'm probably talking to Bruce was the thing that really clinched the deal for me because Bruce not only understands, Bruce is a phenomenal academic, but he's an incredible pastor as well. And he really understands that kind of human spiritual truth at the heart of John Newton's story. But for me, the other way in, the first sort of doorway that opened for me with John Newton's story was understanding that, gosh, this is a guy, this is a story of a man who went through some very, very understandable, very deeply traumatic experiences. So his mother died when he was a child. His father was a merchant seaman. He was a captain, I think, and he was away a lot. And he then remarried, and young John Newton didn't get on too well with his stepmother and his siblings. Life was
difficult.
The
dad was harsh, right? The dad was pretty harsh.
The dad was a bit of a peacock. Dad had a bit of a swagger about him. Mm. And the teenage John Newton kind of then sort of lent into that a little bit and sort of emulated that, tried to emulate him to a degree. And there's a period of time when John Newton appears to just to annoy almost everybody that he spends time with. The more people got to know him, the less they liked him. It appears like he was perhaps trying too hard. He was, he was a bit of a buffoon. He played to the crowd. He made dumb choices, but from a very understandable perspective of someone who's quite hurt and perhaps really wanted, acceptance and love. And he was chasing after those very kind of ordinary things. And I think that's what sort of really fascinated me. And I think my background is I don't really write historical memoirs or biographies. I'm not a historian. I'm not that thorough. I write memoirs with living people. And thanks to being able to talk to Bruce about John Newton, he really did become a living person as we talked.
Well, let's pause here. When we come back, I want you to talk a little bit about that rough past, because, you know, we think of teens now who maybe act up and are suspended from school. Well, John Newton was actually shackled and flogged and, you know, I mean, shipwrecked, basically. There's so much that happened to him that humbled him, and then it would seem like it got into his heart a little bit, and then he got hard-hearted again. So it's almost like God was intervening multiple times to save his life, to spare him, and it softened his heart for a bit, and then it didn't. And so that journey to get him to the place where he was ready to write Amazing Grace, we'll talk about that. Talking to Bruce Hindmarsh and Craig Borlase, they co-authored this book, Amazing Grace, The Life of John Newton and the Surprising Story Behind His Song. You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. If you've got questions about John Newton's life, you know, he was a slave trader and a professed Christian studying his Bible. There was a time where those two things were running parallel. How is that so? And then how did God's conviction get into his soul? I can't wait to find out. Talk more with these guys in just a moment.
Do you want to transform your life? Then read the Bible. Hi, I'm Angela, host of Reading the Bible Together. And maybe you're thinking, that's great, but where do I start? We have great study guides and podcasts on a bunch of different studies from Reading the Bible Together. You can find all the information, get the free study guide, listen to the free podcast, find it all at myfaithradio.com. Just look for Reading the Bible Together resource page.
The chains are gone. I've been set free.
This is an encore presentation of Susie Larson Live.
Has ransomed me, and like a flood, his mercy reigns, unending love, amazing grace.
Thanks for tuning in to Susie Larson Live. We're talking about that song, Amazing Grace, and its writer, John Newton, and the amazing story behind the song. Bruce Hindmarsh and Craig Borlase are my guests today. Bruce is the historian. Craig is he's been a ghostwriter for many big books, and together they partnered to write this story that reads like a novel. Amazing Grace, The Life of John Newton and the Surprising Story Behind His Song. You get a glimpse into the transatlantic slave trade. You get a glimpse into this conflict of him studying his Bible, writing love letters to his wife while there are slaves down below. It's so hard for me, you know, to just fathom, but this happened. And this story is an honest portrayal of John Newton's life. We got a handful of copies to give away. You can text the word book to get in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. 2484. And Bruce, let's talk a bit more about John's backstory, because he had some pretty rough, you know, situations he found himself in. And some of it was his own doing, and some of it was, you know, an over-exaggerated, it seems like, consequence to whatever. Talk about that and even some of the ways God intervened in the process.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, at one point in his teen years, he, you know, later he writes and he looks back and he says, my motto was never deliberate. And maybe we can think of teenagers we know like that, that, you know, maybe they haven't grown a prefrontal cortex yet or something, but they, they just, you know, the decisions are utterly reckless without any regard for the future. And this is the way he described himself when he was young. And, you know, he fell punch drunk in love with this young woman. And three times in a row in the month of December, he stayed on, he overstayed, he couldn't leave her presence, and he got in trouble with his father. He messed up plans people had for his life. He got in trouble with the Navy, and he just kind of kept getting into trouble. And we have a kind of sympathy for him as a young man who maybe he's making reckless decisions. Some awful things are happening to him. Craig talked about the death of his mother when he was young and about a severe overbearing father. But then at about 18 years of age, he again, carelessly, he's out and about wearing his kind of Czech sailor's shirt, and he can be identified as a sailor, and war is kind of threatening. You know, England is about to go to war, and he gets legally kidnapped. He gets impressed into, you know, His Majesty's Navy. And it really was a kind of brutal life into which he was initiated. And at 18 years of age, he finds himself in the Navy. And he, and even there, he kind of, you know, he's a bit of a jerk in how he's treating the common sailors. His father managed to get him promoted to a midshipman, a junior officer, but he's kind of swaggering, like Craig was saying, and kind of the authority is kind of going to his head. And yet at a certain point when he, you know, he didn't really want to be on this ship, he went AWOL. He just kind of left and walked away, which you don't do when you're in the Navy. And he kind of thought maybe his father could sort this out and find him another position or something. But he gets brought back in chains, and he gets brought back onto the ship in chains, and he is whipped with a cat of nine tails. He is demoted, and all of a sudden he has to keep company with the people that he's just been lording it over. And that's a pretty dark moment when that ship, I think it's around 1745, when it leaves the coast of England, he's looking over the gunwales and thinking of murder, suicide. He's thinking about killing the captain and killing himself. And it just goes from there. In a way, there's a kind of descent into darkness. And you can see awful things were happening to him. But then increasingly, he was, like happens for many of us, well, for all of us, we become complicit in our own suffering, you know, things we're doing. And so he's exchanged. You know, May 1745, he maybe the captain, you know, on the naval ship realized that this John Newton was a bit of a problem. And so he gets traded out of the Navy for some other sailors. And he finds himself off the coast of West Africa for the first time on a slave ship. And really, he's trying to escape the Navy and get out of the Navy, but he finds himself on a slave ship. 6 months later, he's on the Guinea coast of Africa. And here he is thinking, you know, again, he made an impetuous decision without checking into things. He kind of apprentices himself to, they had these little coastal stations where they would gather slaves. And he kind of apprentices himself to somebody there who's setting up a new, really, it's almost like a little wholesale factory, they called them, where they would gather the slaves. And he thought maybe he could work there and make some money and do okay. But instead, this is the point at which he, you know, so many people had kind of malarial kind of diseases. He becomes, has a near-death illness. He suffers near-death starvation. He suffers abuse. He is himself put into chains. His master and the master's black mistress named P.I. didn't trust him. And he ends up being enslaved. And he ends up, it's only the mercy of the other slaves and servants that, you know, brought him food that sort of sustained him during those years. But it's quite a low point for him that he reaches. So think of a 21-year-old young man, made a lot of foolish decisions. He's unloved, far from home, and looks like he may die that way. And and that's only the first part. I mean, and there's much, much more to his story than that. But that's already at 21 years of age, we see that he sunk that low.
So thank you for that, Bruce. So when he first, you know, when he left the Navy, was traded to this slave ship, was he at all at once, you know, repelled by the slave trade? Or was it just something that they didn't even think about? I mean, you know what I'm saying? And it was, you know, at what point did his convictions start to get to him?
Yeah. I think this is the most uncomfortable part of the story for the, it's going to be for the reader. And the way we've written the book, and Craig has done such a good job of the writing, but is it's show, don't tell, and maintaining the point of view and letting the reader feel just how uncomfortable this is. And it's raising the questions, how could he? How could he not realize? And it's like tectonic plates are overlapping and you can feel the tension. You know, but I've been reading more and more, Susie, about sort of the history of slavery and the history of abolition. And it's the thing that's so hard for us to realize today. In a way, it's a product of the success of the abolition movement and some of the other movements of the 19th century. What's so hard for us to appreciate is how widespread this was, how people just did not see it. Majorities routinely oppressed minorities. An age that considered itself enlightened in Europe accepted the slave trade. And Newton grew up in Wapping in East London in a community where there's lots of sailors and lots of ship captains. But that whole world, this was just completely widely accepted. And it's just a precious few that are beginning in the 1750s in Europe and in America, some Quakers that are beginning to raise questions, you know, about this and whether this is right or not. It's a bit of a shocking thing to realize, and it makes me wonder how easily, you know, I can be self-deceived. What are the things that I am blind to? What are the things that are written in letters too large to read? So I think when Newton, you know, in 1745, when he first encounters a slave ship, I'm sure there was a sense of danger, you know, because this was a dangerous, you know, occupation to be in and a dangerous kind of interaction and fraught with danger. He was a steward on that first ship and sort of managing supplies and so on. But I think he was just relieved to be out of the Navy.
Wow, let's pause here. Wow, yeah. Sorry about that. Hard break here. When we come back, we'll pick up his story from there. And at what point did God start to become real to him? Because God had intervened. He had these soft-hearted moments, and then his heart hardened again. But then imagine that. He becomes a slave himself. At what point, then, does he humble himself enough to really receive God's goodness and start to be transformed from the inside out? We're talking about John Newton's story. He's the author of Amazing Grace, the writer of Amazing Grace. We'll be back in a minute. This is an encore presentation of Susie Larson Live. You are the same God. Thanks so much for tuning into Susie Larson Live, talking to co-authors Bruce Hindmarsh, Craig Borlase. Together they co-wrote Amazing Grace, the life of John Newton and the surprising story behind his song. Bruce is the historian, Craig is the wordsmith, and boy, they've crafted a book that reads like a novel but gives you this historical account of John Newton's life. You get a peek into the wretches of slave trade and the really messy, painful, broken journey of John Newton until he comes into the knowledge of grace that changes and saves him. Really quite a story. At this point of the story, Craig, John Newton escapes the Navy or is traded off of that Navy ship where he was suffering, but he finds himself on a slave ship. But how come then was he enslaved? Did they not like him either? Was he up to things again, up to no good? Or how did he find himself back in chains?
Okay, yeah, Susie. So when he was in just off the coast of west coast of Africa, and he was working for the guy who was had this wholesale little business. It started out like it was going to be a fairly decent, working relationship, but it went south. His relationship with the guy's mistress really kind of deteriorated, and the guy started to mistrust him, and he was ill, and one thing led to another, and it all spiraled. At some point, we think he wrote a letter, isn't that right, Bruce? He wrote a letter to his father, and that's maybe a year or so after that, his father was able to send word, send rescue, and so there he is. He's managed to get out of his slavery because, he was just useless, and this slave trader didn't want him around anymore. And another slave trader thought, well, I can make use of him. So he improved the situation a little bit. But then his ship turns up, and onto shore comes someone saying, does anybody know John Newton, basically? So that was it. It was his dad had spoke to a slave trader or a trader who was going down the coast. He thought that John was somewhere on the West Coast. And so he was just going around asking if anybody knew where John Newton was. And there you go. He got rescued. He got put back on a boat. But in sort of nothing is simple in John Newton's story. The captain who enticed John Newton back onto the boat to get him back to England had to tell him a little bit of a lie. He said, well, actually, you've been left a whole load of money, a huge fortune. So you get on the boat, come with us, and you can come back to England and get your fortune back. Because initially, John Newton, for him, he was so in love with this Mary Catlett, who he called Polly. This was the woman who had this relationship, this hope of marrying her had driven him, driven so many of his decisions. That's why he'd left the Navy. That's why he'd gone AWOL. Ultimately, why he ended up getting whipped. But he was so shamed by what he'd been through, so shamed by his experiences and how far he'd descended, that he really felt that he perhaps wasn't worthy of her. So how could he go back to England? How could he see her again? Would she accept him? But they promised this little bit of money, perhaps changed his mind a little bit. And he got back on the boat and traveled back. Anyway, they're kind of heading back across the North Atlantic, heading towards the UK, and they hit a storm. And before this point, John Newton had been slipping back into some of his old ways, being a bit of a buffoon, bit of a jerk, as Bruce said. And along comes this storm. And in the middle of this storm, when people are getting swept to their death, John Newton exclaims, if God doesn't help us, we're finished. John Newton is just shocked by this. He's really pulled up short. Hang on, he thinks. I obviously still believe. There's obviously some faith left in me. And that was a moment that really gave him pause. The storm abated. The ship was somehow able to keep going. And John Newton, from that point on, started to realize, oh, perhaps there is grace for me. Perhaps God does still care about me. And that was the beginning, but it was a long, long, long journey from there onwards.
Not a straight line, definitely. No. Not a straight line from point A to point B. Well, Bruce, take us to that point along this messy way when he started to feel bothered about the slave trade before he wrote the song, when it was just starting to, his conscience was starting to get to him.
That storm, in a sense, that external storm, 1748, it's March 2nd today. In 20 days, it will be the 275-year anniversary of the storm. Wow. In a sense, there's a storm that got his attention. But then there has to be, in a sense, a kind of inner storm in his own spirit, because it sort of awakened him. It awakened his conscience. He knew there's something going on here, and perhaps there could be mercy for me. And he tries to be more observant. But then he ends up, as the sort of, you know, they return to Ireland and then to England, then he ends up as first mate on another slave ship. And he said he returned, actually the ship that he was on where the storm happened wasn't a slave ship, but he ends up joining a slave ship and 1749. And he said he returned like a dog to his vomit. So it was like all these religious resolves, all these attempts to kind of, okay, this is serious. I need to live up to these expectations. He ended up back on the coast of Africa, back on the same island where so much misery had happened to him. He's malarial again. He's got an awful fever. God gets his attention again. But this time he says, it's like the alcoholic who comes to the very bottom and has to let go completely. And I need help from beyond myself. And he said this was a different kind of conversion. This is where he knew he really needed God to do something for him that he couldn't do for himself. And when he really yielded and gave up everything. And he said from that moment, he said there was a kind of peace that came to him. Even his health began to recover. But as you notice, Susie, and as the reader will feel, we're still a bit uncomfortable because here his conversion has begun. He's genuinely turned to God for grace and for mercy, but he's still involved in the slave trade. And he will be involved in the slave trade. He will become a captain of a slave ship.
Wow.
He'll make three voyages as captain of a slave ship while he's making his first faltering steps to begin to follow Christ.
Wow.
And we feel that tension. And again, the way we've narrated it for the reader will feel that tension. Feel like, what's going on here? How come he's not recognizing this? And is it really possible that people were so self-deceived that that people did not see the incongruence here? You know, people, you know, that study, you know, the slave trade recognized Newton was not the worst of the slave traders, that he thought of it like a jailer and he wanted to use only as much force as was necessary to keep everybody safe and so on. But he was a slave trader. Mm-hmm. And in 1754, he had a, let's call it an epileptic fit. He had a kind of fit, left him unconscious for an hour in Liverpool when he was about to become go out again as master of a slave ship. And that from that point on, he left the slave trade. So 1754, how old is he? He's in his late 20s. And he's out of the slave trade. And there's a kind of long journey of kind of studying. It may be some scholars think he began to develop anti-slavery sentiment as early as the sort of early 1760s, but he's not saying much about it. And so is it shame that's keeping him quiet? Is it, we don't know exactly why he's keeping quiet about this. Not a lot of people are speaking out about slavery at that point. He begins a path to Bible study. No question, God begins to work in his life. He's relieved that he's out of the slave trade. It was an unpleasant business. And he becomes a pastor. And he becomes an effective pastor. And the village of Olney, kind of a small market town of about 2,000 people, sees a kind of revival under his ministry. And it's 25 years after that storm at sea, that on a New Year's, you know, at the turn of the year, in his study in the vicarage, that he writes the hymn Amazing Grace. And he wants the congregation to look back on how grace has led me safe thus far and how grace will lead me home. And it becomes an act of recollecting how God has led us, trusting God to lead us into the future. And he's a keen sense of the grace of God and how much God has done for him and how much he's been forgiven. And he thinks about his blasphemous past. He thinks about his sort of wicked behavior. But it's really in the 1780s that he comes to realize and to publicly reckon with what he had been and what he had done in his 20s when he was a slave trader. And it's some of the most moving parts of the book for me when in his 60s he begins to reckon with and begins to realize just how awful this was. And he talked about shuddering, a kind of horror to look back. at one point in a letter where he talked about some of the worst atrocities that he had observed. He wrote to, a member of the abolition committee. He said, "I hope God has forgiven me, but I ought to walk softly all my days in remembrance of what I have been and what I have done." He ended up making real efforts to try to destroy the system that he had been a part of. He gave evidence to, two committees of the House of Commons. His own eyewitness testimony about the slave trade. He encouraged Wilberforce to stay in politics and go forward with abolition. He spoke publicly. He spoke privately. He wrote one of the most important tracts against the slave trade that was really important and really public. And as Craig noticed, he was doing all of this while his wife was dying. So it's in the midst of an awful lot of personal pain and sorrow that he is stepping out and bringing shame upon himself, making a public confession, and then beginning to make amends. So again, it's like we talked about earlier, seeing grace, God's grace operating over a whole lifespan to change somebody. And as a whole society is becoming awakened to the fact that when we put sugar in our tea and stir the sugar into our tea, it's a part of a bloody supply chain. And what have we been doing? What have we been doing as a nation? And as people begin to realize all of this, Newton has to reckon with that. And he reckons with it publicly.
Wow. Thank the Lord for his courage and for Wilberforce's courage. You might have said this, I just didn't catch it. How did Wilberforce and Newton meet?
They had connections earlier when Wilberforce was a boy, and Newton knew Wilberforce's aunt. And so Wilberforce thought of Newton as the kind of grand old man, a figure from his youth, a sort of trusted pastor. And so when in 1785, William Wilberforce goes through his own conversion experience, helped along by Isaac Milner and some others that were kind of coaching him and mentoring him, he then went out and made the walk out to visit his old pastor, John Newton, but he was a bit embarrassed. Here he is as a public figure, a well-known public figure, and he had to walk around the block a couple times, worried that people might see him going to talk to this fanatical preacher, this Methodistical preacher, and knocks on the door, and Newton welcomes him into his study. And they begin to talk, and he counsels him about his faith and about making how to be a Christian in public. And they develop a warm personal relationship. I think today we would say that Newton was his spiritual director, but also Wilberforce's sons said that Newton just had, that almost every time they met, he couldn't help talking about the slave trade and talking about it. And there's no question that Wilberforce would have gained a lot of insight into the slave trade from Newton and been encouraged by him to take this up as a cause. And it was a long struggle against vested interests and the West Indian planters and their lobby in Parliament. And it was a long journey toward abolition, but they get there in the end.
They do. If you haven't seen, friends, the Amazing Grace movie on William Wilberforce, I highly, highly recommend it. You've got to see it. We're going to pause here. We're going to come back. I'd love to know, did you get the sense that John Newton, though he obviously grasped grace enough to write the infamous song, did he have lingering senses of condemnation throughout his life? Or was there a point where he really came into a place of going, all of it is under the blood? I mean, it would be so hard. I'm thinking Paul, wonder what Paul's struggle was like, that persecuting, killing Christians, and then called to be, a voice for the gospel. Wow. Then the other thing I want to ask you about is our capacity for self-deception. You think of other Christians in Hitler's Nazi Germany, in the Rwandan genocide. I mean, places where churches were supposed to be havens and they became traps. Like, how do we get so deceived? And are we deceived in our day? In what ways? We'll explore that when we come back. Talking to Bruce Hindmarsh, Craig Borlase, the book Amazing Grace, The Life of John Newton, and the surprising story behind the song. Back in a minute. This is Susie Larson, host of Susie Larson Live. I don't know about you, but I love consistent nourishment. I love to fast on occasion. There's a purpose in that. But if you go too long without eating on a regular basis because you're too busy, your body actually goes into crisis mode. Well, in the same way, your soul, your spirit, they need nourishment too. And that's why it's so important to be listening to scripture, listening to good teaching on a consistent basis throughout the day. That's why we're here. We love what we do, and we want to do it with you. If you listen on the radio, on the terrestrial signal, we encourage you, download our free Faith Radio app. That way, if you're traveling this season, you can take us with you wherever you go. You can catch the live shows or even the podcast after the fact. And we've made it easier than ever. All you have to do is text the word app to 877-933-2484 and then click the link. I hope you will walk with us on this journey. Greater things are yet to be done in and all around us because God, well, he's on the move.
You got pain. He's a pain taker.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Susie Larson Live.
He's a way maker. If you need freedom, save it. He's a prison shaking savior. If you got chains, he's a chain breaker.
Thanks for tuning in to Susie Larson Live, talking to co-authors Bruce Hindmarsh, Craig Borlase. They co-authored the book Amazing Grace, The Life of John Newton and the Surprising Story Behind His Song. If you like reading, this reads like a novel, but gives you this historical account of John Newton's life and the story behind the song and a peek into the wretched slave trade. I've watched movies. I forced myself to watch these movies because I want to know. But it's just such a painful part of our history, isn't it? You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing. Really an amazing, phenomenal read and just such a picture of God's amazing grace. 877-933-2484. And this is what they write. In John Newton's life, we see a parable of how we need grace far more than we initially thought. We see that we've been complicit in things that have been deeply hurtful to others. We see that the older we get, the more we need grace. For the closer we get to the light, the more the impurities show up. Maturity means knowing more and more how much we stand in need of God's grace and walking, therefore, in humility and gentleness, just as Newton did. But at every step, God is at work, calling us home to himself. Wow, there's so much. I have so many questions, so I'm going to see if I can keep them concise. First, let's talk, if we can, about self-deception. I mean, you think about those days and you know, Christians advocating for slavery, just the blindness of that. And we do some work in Rwanda and learned about, in the genocide, how churches had actually become traps in places. So they're very suspect if Americans come and want to help, that we're connected to a denomination or not. And so all that to say, talk, if you would, I'd love to hear from both of you, just on our capacity to be deceived and how that should really keep us very humble and dependent on God. And Craig, I'll start with you.
I think that it's tempting, isn't it, to go binary on all these kind of things. I think I was aware when we started working on the book that it was, there was two strong temptations. One was to, you know, try and build a statue to Newton, the other is to try and topple it. You know, do you put him on a pedestal or do you trash him entirely? And we didn't want to do either of those. It feels like that just misses the point. The point is that that Newton is, it's not amazing John Newton, it's amazing grace. The point is that Newton was a sinner, that he made bad decisions, and that's not the end of the story. The remarkable part of the story is that in spite of, or perhaps because of, his sin and his shame and all the things he did wrong, God was still there, arms open wide, inviting him to himself. And those are uncomfortable stories. Those are really uncomfortable stories because, yeah, at some point when you engage in those, you do have to think, so where am I? What are the things I feel shame about? And our capacity for self-deception, I mean, yeah, like, to a degree, I don't want to minimize it, but of course, like, we do all the time, don't we? That's it. It's to some degree is part of our emotional toolkit. It can be part of our armor. It can be part of our self-preservation. Knowing what of yourself to share, what not to share, that's an issue today. But it so easily tips over into sin. It so easily tips over into just egregious mistakes which hurt and wound and cause so much pain to others. So I don't know. I see it as part of the human condition. I see it as something that is no way is it too much for God. I think God absolutely meets us in that. But I think the difficulty of acknowledging our shame, our sin, where we're going wrong is as hard as it ever was.
Indeed. Yeah. I love your answer, Craig. I love it so much because we are in a day where, you know, it saddens me so much where people ask questions not to get to know you, but in order to either validate or vilify you. You're either on this side and you're good or this side and you're bad, you know, where we've reduced people to topics. And so I love that you didn't put them on a pedestal or trash the pedestal, but this is an honest story. And I think if anybody, any one of us had our story written, the honest truth, we would only have to grace to claim, right?
Yeah. You know, Susie, 1793, so Newton is getting much older. He wrote custom, example, and interest had blinded my eyes. So custom, everybody accepts it. Example, everybody I know and people I respect, it's okay with them. The majority all accepts this. And then interest, it's actually in my financial or somehow in my self-interest. Wow. And those things together had blinded him. This takes us a little bit out of John Newton's story, but I'm reading a lot of sort of Russian history and spirituality right now. And I have been reading the long, unabridged edition of Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. And the famous line that you often hear people quote or you'll hear in sermons is when he says, the line that divides good and evil is not a line that kind of runs between parties or political parties or states or individuals. It's a line that goes through every human heart. That's the famous line. But reading it in context, it's in a chapter called Blue Caps, where he's talking about the mid-level bureaucrats who were implicated in so many of the atrocities and the senseless cruelties and the miscarriages of justice, and that involved millions of people being unjustly imprisoned, persecuted, and killed. And he himself was a victim of that, of course. He was on the receiving end of all of this oppression. But where that appears in the chapter in which it appears is when he says, having narrated wave after wave of senseless cruelty and atrocity that is almost nauseating, where that appears, he says, if things had just been a little bit different, and if I had made a couple compromises, if I had been educated just a little bit differently, I might have been one of those blue caps. I might have been one of those ones who was implicated in these atrocities. So if anybody could have divided the world into just two kinds of people, there's oppressors and victims, and that's it. There's bad people and good people. Surely it was Solzhenitsyn. You know, he had every right, in a sense, to do that, but that's not what he did. He realized that the possibilities of self-deception go so deep that he realized, you know, just if it had been a little bit different, it could have been me.
Wow.
And so again, I come back to John Newton saying at the end of his life, I need to walk softly. I think we all need to walk softly. Wow. He said, in remembrance of what I have been and what I have done, our need for the grace of God just runs deeper than we probably realize.
Wow, just brilliant. Wow. Just got about a minute and a half left, and I would love to know from both of you just where you stand now. What do you know about God now that you didn't know or didn't know as well 5 or 10 years ago? Craig, I'll start with you.
That it's still okay, and it still takes time to grapple with the truth of how kind God is. And I think I just turned 50. If I'm still around another 50 years, I'm probably still going to be grappling with that one. And that's pretty good. That's okay.
Wow. How about you, Bruce?
Well, I think very similar is just to realize more deeply that at the very center of the universe is not, you know, it's not power. It's not, you know, the fundamental physical forces of the universe and, you know, the whole universe together. The very center is a God of love who wants us to be blessed with his blessedness. And he's absolutely determined to, you know, to pursue us and to reach us. And just to realize that how deeply his love goes, and that it's enough, that forgiveness is real and that mercy is real.
Wow. Well, gentlemen, this conversation was pure gold today. Thank you for your incredible stewardship of the story and of your hearts and of the faith. I feel so much richer for having this conversation, and I pray this book surprises you both. Thank you. Thank you for the time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susie.
Man, so good. So good. Wow. Bruce Hindmarsh, Craig Borlase are my guests today. They co-authored a really brilliant book. I'm thinking this book's going to win some awards. Just watch Amazing Grace, The Life of John Newton and the Surprising Story Behind His Song. Hey, we'll leave that drawing open for a little bit longer. You can text the word book to get in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. We'll meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to Susie Larson Live. Podcasts like mine are available because of your support. If it's important to you to hear things that encourage your faith, click the link in the show notes and give now.